Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, why you might pay thousands more to have a baby or get a new knee in one Minnesota hospital than another. That's what a report released earlier this month from the state health department finds, and we wanted to understand more about why this happens. Why is it that getting a hip replaced in one hospital through one insurer would cost what a used Chevy Suburban will run you, and the same operation in a different hospital with a different insurer will cost what a brand new Lincoln Continental costs? Why should there be such a huge difference? And it isn't just insurer to insurer. You'll also find huge price differences for the same operation city to city. We've talked about that on this show before. We're going to talk about why. We're also going to open the phone lines to get your thoughts and questions on this. How concerned or aware are you of what your health care costs, especially the big stuff, like a procedure, an operation, a big test? Do you think your insurance premiums may be getting more expensive because your insurer is paying too much for care that could be cheaper? So I want to know about your own awareness, your knowledge about what your insurer may be paying for healthcare procedures. I know a lot of the time this is information that's hard to get, but are you concerned that your premiums reflect the fact that your health insurers have not negotiated a very good deal, that they're paying more for health care than is necessary? Here's the number on that. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter, at CarrieMPR. Julie Sonier is with us. She's the president of Minnesota Community Measurement. She's in the studio. Julie, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Good morning.
Stefan Gildemeister is with us. He's the state health economist, and this is where the report came from that we're talking about today. And Stefan, welcome. Good to have you on the show.
Good morning. Thank you.
Stefan, was I exaggerating when I use those comparisons of the used Chevy Suburban and the brand new Lincoln Continental, the differences in the price you would pay for a procedure?
I have to admit, I know the car prices less well than you, so I think you're probably right on that. But the numbers that you quoted were directly from the report, and those are the differences we saw, including within hospitals.
Did you also find that there were certain procedures where you would see these big gaps, or did you find this down a list of many different procedures and operations?
Well, this is the first of a series of analyses where we wanted to look at common procedures, what we found across these four first procedures, orthopedic and birth outcomes, were these differences. I think our sense is that this is not limited to certain kind of tests or services or procedures, but it's kind of a symptom of how the markets currently work, and sort of the lack of transparency contributing to variation existing sort of underneath that.
Okay. So, Julie, explain to me why this is a result, as Stefan says, of the way the markets work. I don't really understand that.
Well, there's a few... A few different things that happen in terms of how healthcare is priced, and I will be the first person to say that I think it is useful to shine a light on variation in prices, but I think that it is also ultimately of limited use. I think we also need to be thinking about quality, and also we know the price for a service, but I think we need to think about efficiency. So you could go to a low-cost provider, and they could do a lot of things, and ultimately that could be more expensive. So that's price is just one part of the conversation.
But it is a part of it, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. As we know, we have a market-based system where prices are negotiated between healthcare providers and health insurance companies. And there's a lot of different factors that affect that.
Like so what?
One of those is negotiating leverage. So depends on the location of the facility, the size of the facility. One of the things that we've seen happen in this market and across the country over the past couple of decades is organization of hospitals and clinics into larger systems. And one of the reasons, but not the only reason for that, is to gain pricing leverage. And on the other side, we've also seen health insurance companies getting larger and larger and consolidating as well. So the situation that we have now is very often, you know, large players negotiating with each other.
So let me ask you about that. That's interesting. So the consolidation, let's say, among hospitals, medical groups, does that give you, do you find that that gives you more leverage to charge more? Or is the argument of we're consolidating because this is going to be more efficient for the patient and for the market? Are you finding that, yes, insurers are getting a better deal at the procedures at these big consolidated groups? You see what I'm asking?
Yep. And I think one of the limiting factors is what else is happening in that community. So you could have a community where a small rural community where there's one hospital and that hospital has pretty good negotiating leverage.
They've got the monopoly,
because
right?
Because it's a long distance to the closest alternative.
Okay. So they can charge what they pretty much what they want.
Well, not necessarily. I think there's limits on, you know, there's going to be limits on that, and it will depend on, you know, every health plan is going to take a different strategy for negotiating. But in the Twin Cities, what you have is, you know, several large systems. So you do have alternatives. And we see this happen occasionally. It'll sort of, you know, there'll be some high profile dispute between a health provider and a hospital about contract. And it'll come up to the edge about whether that provider will be in the network. You know, I think that employers have a role in this as well, and consumers as well. One of the things that we learned in the 1990s in the managed care was that people have a strong preference for having a choice of providers. And that's one of the things that affects the dynamics of those negotiations.
Stefan, not to leave for a moment the consolidation here, because this is an interesting element. What did you find in the report? What was the influence of these larger consolidated groups and the leverage that they can apply on pricing?
Yeah, it's a good question, but it's tricky for me to answer because we're with the data, with the way the data is structured, we're not permitted by state law to identify hospitals or the medical systems they're part of. So we can't say that much about that. But I think Julie's point is a good one in that what we know from the degree of variation across the country and the reasons underlying that variation is that relative market power matters, whether they're alternatives to delivering a service matters, and sort of the dynamics in a given market matter as well. What was so interesting about this study for us was that employers, and we work with self-insured employers on this project, they just didn't have this information. They didn't know what the spread of prices are for these services.
Mm-hmm.
And for their purpose to negotiate good rates for the employees, they just wanted to see some of that data. And that was their biggest ask, in other words, in improving delivery of healthcare services to their patients.
Okay.
That was sort of a white spot for them.
Let me grab a call. I'll come back on the employers thing, Julie, because I know you wanted to talk about that. And I want to understand what that means for employers who are signing on with insurers and then their own leverage on that. But to a call here to Pavel in Hi, you're a surgeon. Is that right?
Yes. I work here in Twin Cities. And in my specialty, this is just an amazing topic. Because in my specialty, one of the most common, say, surgeries we do that's insurance-based in plastic and reconstructive surgery is, for example, breast reduction.
Uh-huh.
Very standard procedure, very common. I can, on my end, be paid as little as, say, you know, $800 or $5,000 on the high end. And the worst part of it is that you really never know for months after the surgery which number it is going to be. You know, depending on insurance.
Wow.
Company.
So you're saying that your reimbursement rate for your work in a given surgery, the spread is it sounds like, as wide on that as some of we're seeing hospital to hospital.
Oh, absolutely. And what is ironic is that when I bring a patient, say, for a cosmetic procedure to a hospital, and it's, let's just say, it's a very well-defined surgery, like, again, say, tummy tuck.
Uh-huh.
Up front, everybody knows that the hospital is going to charge the patient, say, $2,000 or $2,500 for the hospital and anesthesia fees for that 2.5 hour surgery. And everybody knows that up front, no questions asked, patient pays directly to the hospital, services given. Mm-hmm. And yet, if you try to obtain that information for other insurance-based surgeries, you will pretty much never be able to find out how much a surgery, say you want to have a gallbladder done. I doubt you would ever find out how much it's going to cost up front if you were to pay out of your own pocket. That's probably it. I think that covers those comments. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks very much for the call. So, Julie, what do you make of that? A physician who does the same work, the same kind of care, even he doesn't know what the reimbursement rate is going to be.
It's a complex system, and I think that there's so much that about reimbursement that also depends on what happens during a procedure. That is not necessarily surprising that there's indeterminate. I'm not saying that's not a problem, that there's a lot of wide variation. That's something that we have known in Minnesota and across the nation for a long time, that we have all of this price variation. So at my organization, Minnesota Community Measurement, we actually publish average price data for about 120 different common procedures on our website that consumers can go and see. They're not the high-dollar things, so they're not like the surgeries that cost $30,000, but they are the more common things. So office visits, lab tests, imaging, the kinds of things that consumers might, most people might have more commonly. So that's one place to look. My health plan, which I happen to be enrolled in a health partners plan, I have that information available to me as a consumer as well. And so I think we're starting to, and I think this pressure from consumers and employers and all of the attention to price transparency is starting to result in more relevant information for consumers. What we really need is information that's timely. It's specific to the individual consumer's circumstances.
And so, how about fairly easily to get as you're planning a surgery or something, right?
Absolutely. So through our website depends on, there's probably variation in this community across the health plans, but people can certainly, the information is becoming easier to get, would say.
Stefan, I want to come back to you on something that our surgeon said, which is if you were having a gallbladder surgery, it would be very difficult to get the information about how much the hospital was going to charge, all the breakdown of the surgery. Is that true right now, or can you advise ways around that?
I think the information exists. It's just not, we're just not prepared to produce it in a way that is easily accessible or can be consumed even by doctors. So if we talk with our care teams, they have general senses, but it's rare that folks can tell you this costs this much and this costs less. And it's just because the system hasn't really been built around that information being available. But there's also that confusion or that complexity about, depending on which contract or which network you're in, the prices differ. So that adds complexity and inefficiency to the system. And our work, so I agree with much what Julie has been saying about what's important to really make consumers successful contributors to weeding out this price variation. But our work was more intended to be working at the system level and sort of point out these inefficiencies and effectively the resulting waste in the system from pricing failures and from lack of information.
Stefan,
but yes, that information exists. It's just really hard to come by.
Stefan, I really appreciate the insight on the report. Thanks very much for being with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for your interest.
Stefan Gildemeister with us. He's the state health economist. I'm going to bring in Renee Shaw. She's a professor and director of health policy studies in the Department of Emergency Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. And she's with us from San Francisco. Renee, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks so much, Julie. Glad to be here.
I'm Carrie. Julie is our other guest. No problem. I know it's early out there. So we've talked about a few of the factors here. Renee, you just, I think, heard Stefan talking about the inefficiencies in the system. Julie talked to us about the competition, some of the consolidation that's been going on in the industry. What else would you point to as the reason for these big price disparities?
Yeah, I think something that's important for people to know is that there's no regulation of prices in healthcare in the United States. Nobody knows what other people charge, and there's no regulation. And so there's also, because our healthcare system is very free market based, which is very American, there's a lot of kind of proprietariness of this information. People are holding on tight to it because that's what gives them a competitive advantage. When you think about an insurance plan, they have no incentive to make these prices known about what they pay, and hospitals have no incentive to make it known about what they charge.
That's interesting. I don't think you heard our surgeon who called in.
I did hear him. Yeah.
Would you concur with that?
I think he's right that it is rare that people know this information even within the system because the system hasn't been built around that. But at the same time, even if hospitals did know and insurance plans certainly know what they pay, there is what insurance plans often invoke is the Freedom of Information Act or the Freedom of Trade. They say that this impedes their level of competition, and so this is information that they are not required to publish.
Yeah. Call here from Matt in Decorah, Iowa. Hi, Matt. What's your question or your comment on this? Hey, Matt, are you there? Okay, we'll see if we can get Matt back on the line. If you've just tuned in, it's a conversation trying to understand some of the details of this report that came out from the Minnesota State Health Department about the big health price disparities that you can pay at one hospital through one insurer a certain amount of money for a knee replacement or an operation, and you will pay, I don't know, in some cases, five or six times that at another hospital through another insurer, trying to get down to some of the details on why this may be, how this information is accessible or not to the average health consumer, and then what to do about it. So Julie Sonier is with us. She's president of the Minnesota Community Measurement organization, and Renee Shaw with us from the Department of Emergency Medicine at UCSF. Want to hear from you today on how concerned or aware you are of your health care costs, especially the big stuff. I mean, is this information that you think you'd want to have that would influence the way that you think about your health care, or do you leave this all up to your insurer? I want to talk about the insurer's part of this too. Do you think your insurance premiums may be being influenced by this? And if you're in the medical field, I'd love to have your view on this as well. That was really interesting insight from our surgeon who called. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000, and on Twitter at CarrieMPR, where Richard says, Minnesota... Uh-oh, just lost it there. Minnesota and most states have a law that states auto insurance companies cannot mandate where consumers get their cars fixed. Why not health insurance? Julie, what, too simplistic or why not?
I'm not sure I understand the question because health plans are not mandating where consumers get their care either.
I actually think he's talking about some regulation, right, on the price.
So asking for regulation on price.
I think that's where he's going with this.
I don't know that that's ever been tried here in Minnesota. The one example that I can think of nationally is the state of Maryland, which mm-hmm. has regulated hospital prices, you know, probably since the 1970s.
Do they have these big disparities in Maryland or not?
That's a good question. I don't know enough about Maryland to know if there's sort of cross-facility variation or variation. I believe there's not variation across the payers, including the public payers, Medicare and Medicaid in Maryland, which is one thing that makes them unique, and it might be worth taking a look at, mm-hmm. you know, do we have that kind of variation? I will say that when we start talking about price regulation, you have to think about what the goals are and what the likely result of that is. And it's probably not going to be that everybody goes to the lowest price. So some of those low price facilities, and this is also potentially an unintended consequence of transparency, when a facility finds out that they're getting a lower price than everybody else, mm-hmm. they may have reason to negotiate for a higher price that's closer to the average. So one impact of transparency or one impact of price regulation could be compression of range of prices,
right,
but not necessarily a large overall impact on cost, depending
Renee,
on how you do it.
And Renee, that wouldn't be a negative thing, would it? It would just mean that there was more equity, I guess, in the market around this.
Well, I think what Julie's getting at, and I agree with, is that there have been some early studies that show that the low price facilities just look at the data if it becomes available and say, whoa, I'm getting paid so little, let me just increase my prices. And so it's not necessarily an effect that we want as a patient or as a consumer who's paying the bill, because you actually want your the prices that you pay to reflect the service that you are getting and the amount that it costs. And right now, there is no relationship between the amount that it actually costs a hospital or a provider to actually do the work and the price that is charged. And I think this lack of relationship means that there's this basically free-for-all in the market. And so price transparency, I think, is what people think of immediately when they say, oh, we need to know these prices. But it may not be the most immediate or most effective solution, because I think really, fundamentally, what this price variation shows is that there is extreme irrationality in the way we pay for care in the United States.
Right.
And these kind of Band-Aid solutions about transparency may not be the answer.
Call here from David in St. Paul. David, you're a physician, is that right?
Yes.
What are you thinking about this discussion?
So one thing I think that needs to be added to the discussion is that the fee schedules, the fees that insurance companies actually pay, are claimed to be proprietary. And I think the only way to fix the system is to create some transparency. And especially if you're on a high deductible plan, as a patient, you end up paying those rates, but you don't know what they are.
Right.
And there's no really good reason to not publish those rates. I mean, I'd be fine having the rates published. And a lot of the reason when you say that's going to, when the previous discussion was talking about having that increase fees, I'm not sure that would be the case. I think it would be more transparent. And the other issue is that there's only a few major insurance companies in the state of Minnesota, and with that they don't necessarily negotiate their rates very openly at all.
David, I want to make sure I understand what you said, though, at the beginning, which is that insurance companies are not required to share the amount that they're paying for a given procedure, and that they resist that. Is that what you're saying?
They won't. Well, what I'm saying is that by contract, they claim that you can't disclose the rates. If you can get the rates from them that they're going to pay you, they tell you you can't disclose them. And they claim that it's proprietary, so that's why that information is not easily available and why it varies so much.
This is why the employers don't know this. But is that right, Julie?
I think that, as I said earlier, it's becoming easier to get that information. I think one of the reasons for that is because we have so many more people in high deductible plans than we had, you know, even 5 years ago.
Right.
And so people really want that information. I think the real trick is if we publish fee schedules, that's just a lot of information for people to process. So I think the real trick of it is getting the right information to the consumer that they want at the right time. And I think we're still learning how to do that. One of the challenges with that, quite frankly, and it's one that my organization has experienced, is you can publish price transparency information, but it is much harder to get people to engage with it. They have to have a reason.
You mean as the consumer?
Exactly. Okay. So it's out there. We don't know how often people use it and what they use it for. There are some studies that show, you know, when you put the price transparency information out there, unless you're giving people a specific reason to use it. So, for example, something in their insurance plan that gives them a reason to seek out a lower cost provider or a higher quality provider, or something that sort of puts them on the hook for if they choose a higher cost provider. It's when you have to combine it with those kinds of incentives in order to really get people to use it well. But I agree with the caller that people who want the information should be able to get it.
So, Renee, I think the way I would want to use this is if I'm in a high deductible plan, my premiums continue to go up.
Yes.
There must be some vehicle for me to understand how my increasing premiums and these high deductible plans are being influenced by the fact that my insurer has not negotiated a very good rate for all the people in our plan that need, you know, a knee replacement. You know what I'm saying?
Right. I think it's true that definitely our premiums are certainly increasing because of this dysfunction in the healthcare system and the way we pay for care. And because people don't know what people charge and insurers don't know what other insurers are paying, everybody's working in a black box. And so I think this other issue of inefficiency that hasn't been mentioned is that we've got hundreds of insurers in the country, thousands of hospitals, and thousands of providers who operate on, you know, independently of hospitals, and each one of these has their own shop who is doing coding and billing and negotiating on different forms and different regulations, creating different claims for each insurer. And that's none of this is providing us any health care service at all.
Jim says on Twitter, the inability to identify specific variants based on data use limitations is very telling. He adds fragmentation, lack of transparency, and a focus on immediate demand, barriers to price shopping, all are significant factors. Put them together, you have the current dynamic. To the phones to Steve in Minneapolis. Steve, what are you thinking about? The ACA, is that right?
Yes. So, well, I am an emergency physician at Hennepin County Medical Center. And I just read a fantastic book that I recommend called An American Sickness by Elizabeth Rosenthal. She wrote the series in the New York Times called Paying Till It Hurts.
Oh, yeah.
And at the beginning of the book, she brings up a great point. We think that insurance companies have incentive to keep prices down, but it's just the opposite. And the first example she gives was a guy who's getting an infusion once a month for psoriasis. It costs $20,000 at one medical center. Then his doctor moves to a medical center 15 blocks away, so he goes with her and keeps getting the infusions, but it costs $120,000 a month, and his insurance company pays it without question. The increase from $20,000 to $120,000 a month. What she then points out is that in the an unintended side effect of the Affordable Care Act was that they mandated that only 15% of the premium can be kept by the insurance company.
Mm-hmm.
Now, even though insurance companies may or may not be nonprofit, it doesn't really mean it's nonprofit. They pay their executives more. So the executives at insurance companies have to find a way to be able to pay themselves more, and what they do is allow the cost of medical care to go up so that they can raise premiums so that 15% of their premium is a lot more money and they can personally make more money.
They're bringing in more money to themselves by raising it so that the 15%, they get a larger share.
That's right. So they have an incentive to allow medical costs to rise so they can charge higher premiums, and then 15% is a greater amount for them to keep.
Let me take this to Julie and Renee. Just stay on the line there, Steve, if you would. Renee, I mean, does that ring true to you?
I think Elizabeth Rosenthal's work is incredible. I think it is very eye-opening, and I absolutely agree that the way the system is structured right now is not in the interest of patients.
What do you think, Julie?
You know, I think that the degree to which that can happen is limited by competition between health plans. And so, you know, we see a very competitive market here in Minnesota. We know that employers are looking very carefully at their premiums, and so are individuals. I'm personally not familiar with the work that's being cited, but I would say that there are certainly limits on that, and it's not something that I have witnessed I should mention that I also used to run the state's largest employer-based purchasing program for state employees, and that's not something that, you know, and we were putting a lot of pressure on the plans that administered our programs mm-hmm. and incorporating incentives into our contracts for them to act as our agents to keep costs down. And we certainly need more of that in the system. I don't know to what degree other employers are doing that as well. But employers obviously have a strong role in advocating for keeping costs down. So we have all of these places in the system where we have different kinds of incentives and people with different incentives. And we need to make sure that all of the contracts and arrangements and everybody's working ultimately on behalf of the consumers that are paying the bill.
Steve, are you still there?
Yeah.
Did you hear our surgeon at the beginning of the show talk about these reimbursements? Now, you said you're in ER, is that right?
Yes.
At a hospital.
Yeah.
So are you aware of the different reimbursement levels for the care that you're providing? Or is that something that affects you?
I don't really know how much one thing costs or what one insurer pays over another. I do know that, you know, at Hennepin County Medical Center, we are 60% Medicaid, and Medicaid controls costs. They say, this is how much we're going to pay for something,
right,
and you don't get any more than that. And I think that's a good thing. You know, I think that we pay too much for medical care in this in our society, and that it costs are out of control because there's no disclosure and many other reasons. We need to have some. It does not work like the normal marketplace does.
Mm. Thanks for the call. Here's Diane. This is interesting on Twitter. She says, in October, my son fractured an ankle while in Germany. He went to the ER. They asked for insurance. It was Blue Cross. And they knew up front that it would cost 208 euros. We paid with Visa, covered the doctor exam, x-ray, and crutches. but also asked for bank information because we would likely get a refund. In December, we got $98 back. Renee, I know the German system is quite different, but couldn't we learn something from that?
Absolutely. There is no question that the way our system is structured can learn from other places. And so I don't think when we talk about solutions, it doesn't mean we need to go whole hog and necessarily be like the Canadian system or have extreme measures where all physicians are employed by the government. And I think that there are ways that we can introduce more governmental oversight to protect patients in ways that make the system a more level playing field. And I think in America, you know, our general tendency is to think that the government might just be impeding on our freedom. Uh-huh. But there is a role for the government to protect us. And this is a good place where I think the market has shown that it is not working well for healthcare. And, you know, when we talk about price transparency, it's true. Dr. Pavel said for cosmetic surgeries, when you talk about a tummy tuck, it's very clear. You know you need, you know, procedure X and you can get a price for it. But when you're throwing up your guts and you have abdominal pain, you have no idea what you need. And price transparency doesn't help you because if they're publishing what it costs for a CT scan or ultrasound, you don't know which one you need. And so it's just healthcare is not one of those things that is conducive to the box of market goods. And that's where we need to be a little bit more humble and say maybe we can learn from other systems.
Julie, we should be also talking about quality and how much healthcare we're consuming. Is that what you're worried about?
That is right. So it's absolutely understandable why we talk a lot about price, especially when that's what individual consumers are facing. I think that when we're thinking about affordability of healthcare overall, if we focus only on price, we're going to miss a big part of the picture. So we also know, and Minnesota Community Measurement has done a lot of this work, there is also a ton of variation in how much services people use. And
okay.
So we do this analysis and we publish it at the medical group level. And it's total cost of care. And so that's, you know, for a patient population that a medical group is taking care of, what's the variation in the total cost of care per person per month? And again, you have more than a twofold difference there. And we also have some insight into, well, is that because of prices or is it because of how much care is being used?
Right.
And it's both, and it can vary across the groups. And so I think that while I'm supportive of price transparency efforts, I worry a little bit that we might miss the bigger picture if we focus only on price. We need to be thinking about total cost of care, and we need to be thinking about quality. So an example is, you know, we might know the price of a knee replacement surgery, but what about the care that takes place before that might be able to prevent the need for the knee replacement surgery? If we're looking at that bigger picture, it's sort of in the longer term best interest of the patient, as opposed to, you know, when we think about just prices, it reminds me of sort of this focus that we have on a fee for service healthcare, where we're just paying for stuff by volume, and we're not caring too much about how much volume there is. So I want to make sure that we have that larger perspective as well.
Renee, I would think you have a perspective on this in the emergency field here, where you specialize.
Right. So I also am an emergency physician. I work at our county hospital in San Francisco. And as someone who is a physician and can see people who come in with different chief complaints, I can see there's a huge variation in the amount of tests that you could order based on your incentives. And I'm not saying that all physicians are greedy, you know, people who are trying to increase the volume just artificially, but I am saying that there is evidence showing that because we have a fee, basically a fee for service system, even though there are some bundled payments that have been introduced in the past decade or so, there is a kind of an unconscious desire, and there's evidence showing that people want to do more, and that's a very American thing. Well, we can do more, this whether it's a cancer patient who's at the end of his or her life, or whether it's a patient with just a little bit of abdominal pain that may not need anything, but you think, oh, maybe I should do a scan just to make sure, because we also practice in a very litigious society. And so I think there are a lot of things pushing us towards higher volume. And there are some factors that can be changed in the terms of the way we pay for care.
Deborah says on Twitter, transparency is also important to the patient when they're sitting in the doctor's office asking for the price a service will cost them. Without that, doctors are more likely to prescribe all tests regardless of the cost to avoid possible legal repercussions, which is what Renee was talking about. Julie, when I think of what you were describing there, I think of a chronic illness like diabetes. Like, how well does the system respond to all of the things that factor into managing diabetes so that person doesn't end up in Renee's ER? I mean, Is that an example of trying to understand better about the kind of care we're supplying and how the system is organized?
It's a great example, and it's one of the things that Minnesota Community Measurement has been working on for over a decade. So, and you know, quality matters, obviously, as well as cost. And one of the reasons that quality matters is when chronic disease is well managed, you have, using the diabetes example, much lower risk of, for example, having a, you know, a heart attack or, you know, having to have a limb amputated. Mm-hmm. And so that's why it's so important. And so one of the quality measures that we have is actually a composite measure of five different things related to outcomes for diabetes.
Got
so
it.
Is your blood pressure controlled? And, you know, are you taking a statin if you need to be? And are you tobacco free? And, you know, that's something that in terms of quality transparency that we publish on our website, mnhealthscores.org, so that people can go and we see huge variation in that measure. So we're now at 46% for the statewide average, but we're anywhere from 0% to 84%.
So this is what I want patients to understand this as. What you're saying is there are health groups that really get this right. They're helping to manage all the chronic factors of diabetes, and there are some that often don't. And so you see those patients back into the ER and having these amputations. I'm just trying to simplify this. Is that
right?
There
is a lot of variation in how well that happens. And I should also mention that we take account of some groups have a sicker patient population than others, and
okay.
we take account of that as best we can. And then the methods that we're using to do that are improving all the time. But we still see that variation. And so I think it's something that patients should be aware of. Another thing to say about that is that that's not about a one individual physician's quality of care.
Mm-hmm.
It's really about a whole team and a system. And how well are patients being monitored, for example, in between appointments, or how well is the clinic reaching out to people who aren't coming in for their repeat visits? And so it really is a team effort. And, you know, we see some great high performance by some groups across the state. And it's our goal really that to share those best practices and so that people can learn from, well, what's going right over here that we should be thinking about implementing.
Renee, there's a big push on that in Minnesota. Same for California, or what do you see on that?
You know, I think Minnesota is doing some really innovative things, and I don't know everything, but I really think that this push towards making quality measures known is really important. And California has done some things in terms of price transparency, but not necessarily in the way of requiring certain measures of quality to be as public in certain ways. And I think that's a way that whether it's a state initiative or a federal initiative is a way that the government can really be effective in helping patients get better quality of care.
So Colorado has this new law called Transparency in Healthcare Prices Act. And this is essentially, Renee, hospitals having to post the cost of procedures if someone was going to self-pay for it themselves, no insurance. Do those numbers mean anything, though, to, you know, most Americans who get their insurance through an employer and for all the reasons that we've been talking about today?
Right. So I think as we have more people in high deductible health plans, in general, people care more about the prices. But at the same time, if you have abdominal pain, you don't know what it is, you go to the ER, you might be able to see what the five hospitals in your area charge for their CT scans and their lab tests, but you don't know what the doctor's going to order. And so even if that's published, you may not have the ability to actually ferret out what you need. You don't know whether you have a ruptured aorta or some bad chicken. That's the point of going to a physician. So having them post exactly what the itemized list of kind of procedures or services are doesn't necessarily help you because you don't know what things on the list you need. And so we call that in economics asymmetry of information, and that's another example of why healthcare is not one of those things where you can shop around easily.
I'm hearing from a physician friend in Alexandria, Deb. She says, I'm listening. This is my jam. I live in the measurements of Minnesota Community Measures. We're doing awesome things in Alexandria with teamwork, quality care, care coordination. Those things put the patient first, and they give the care they want. And then Deb's saying, I need a physician voice. Deb, luckily we've had a number of physicians call in, but I hear you on that, and we'll come back to the discussion again with more doctors involved. A physician on the line, actually, right now, to Happy in Minneapolis. Hi, thanks so much for waiting.
Oh, my pleasure, and thank you for having this discussion. I'm actually in a unique position because I, too, am a graduate of UCSF Family and Community Medicine, and I work now and practice in Minnesota. I would say, I guess, I think what we're talking about or what this is going into, which is what a lot of us in medicine see, which is I am going to evaluate the patient in front of me, and I want my tests and whatever I need to do to be what the best outcome is for the patient. Mm-hmm. And I don't actually know prices. I did not know prices when I was in California. I don't know prices now. And I don't like knowing those going into it because I really want my practice to be about what's right for the patient. I do think we're often in a position in medicine, to use some of the diabetic examples, you know, they reimburse now in primary care based on what someone's blood sugar measure is over the course of 3 months. Mm-hmm. And that's often not in line with what the evidence-based recommendations are. But yet you're reimbursed on that. And then we also do reimbursement in primary care now on patient satisfaction. And although I think there's a goal and we need to be to do right by our patients, when we get into satisfaction, that's not always medicine. You know, medicine really is, I listened to my patient and I did what was right for the patient for outcome. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily, I gave you the antibiotic because you wanted it for the virus.
Right.
And I know I'm tangentializing, but I think it's complicated.
You also said something interesting to me. You said that reimbursements are done on this 3-month measure of blood sugar in diet. And then you said, not evidence. That's not really the way the reimbursement should happen. Why not?
Well, because, for example, and my data might be old, but so people can feel free to correct me. Say we say as a community or the reimbursement from the insurance company is everyone who has a diabetic has to have a hemoglobin 1AC of 7 and below.
Okay.
And there's some evidence now that in elderly people, someone might be doing fine at 7.5. And they are not having an increased risk of a heart attack there. And there's actually some evidence that says really tight control in elderly people leads to worse outcomes in terms of hypoglycemia. But the insurance company is looking at you and going, that patient is 7.5. We are not reimbursing, or they're in the bad pile. So then we're going to pay you less, or we're giving you a lower measure. And I think that's where some of the other physicians have talked about, like going into the ER with abdominal pain. We need to be aware to not just go crazy and not have uniformity, but also we're so driven on some of the data that we don't look at, well, what's the outcome? And what's the outcome with this patient?
This is really interesting. Julie, this is the first time I've heard physicians, and maybe they talk among themselves about this, but I know this is like quality control, right? Being tied to outcomes and reimbursements. I wasn't aware that some physicians are saying that doesn't really get it done either.
Yeah, and I can't speak specifically to how quality measures are used for reimbursement. But to this question about, you know, whether the quality measures are, you know, using evidence, right?
Yes.
So, you know, that's something that at Minnesota Community Measurement, we work really hard on. We have, you know, multi-stakeholder groups. We have a whole committee that meets monthly that tries to make sure that the measures that we have are in line with the best evidence-based guidelines. And so an example of the elderly patient, so the diabetes measures, you know, have an age cap, because I think people agree that, you know, the control, the sort of what the expectations are should be different. So making sure that those guidelines are right. And one of the challenges that we face is that evidence is not static. And so it changes all the time. One of the things that happened late last year, and it affects our diabetes measure and some of our measures for vascular care, is there are new guidelines about what's appropriate blood pressure control. And there is not consensus in the community about whether those guidelines are the right guidelines. But that's a conversation that we'll be having, you know, over the course of the next several months to try to come to consensus about what really should those measures be. But, you know, we're one of the few places in the nation, I think, that has such a great example of the collaborative way of doing this. But that said, it's really hard for me, and I don't have enough information to know, like, how those measures get translated into payment policy.
So, Renee, I'd love your thoughts on this, on what Happy said and then what Julie added there.
Yeah, I think the fact that sometimes the measures may be a little bit off from the guidelines or in terms of what you get paid for when you get reimbursed, I think that's true across the board because things are always changing and evidence comes in. But at the same time, it doesn't mean that the approach is wrong. I actually think the fact that we're paying, there is this move towards paying for performance or making sure that physicians are getting measured for certain things, and
yeah.
While I, as a physician, I don't necessarily want every single action measured, and there is a potential for that to go on the other extreme and be harmful because you're starting to spend all your time focused on that. I think that general approach is a good one.
Call here from Jim in Minnetonka. Jim, it sounds like you were in medical practice until a couple of weeks ago. Is that right?
That's correct. I just retired from a group of five doctors in independent practice for the group's been there for 60 years.
Well, congratulations. So tell me what you're thinking.
Well, so this is a comment about the level playing field comments that were made earlier. And, you know, this is obviously there are so many different complex issues. But one of the issues that sort of was a challenge for our small group was that we're reimbursed at 30 to 40% less than, say, a large group using some of the names of the groups in the city, you know, Fairview, Alina, Health Partners. If I were to go to the Health Partners clinic across the street, have a physical examination, for example, the reimbursement to that physician for doing the exact same thing that I did across the street would be 40% more.
Wow.
And the reason that for that is because that's what the insurance companies can do. They will not negotiate, and we've tried to negotiate with several different insurers and looking at some of the things like Minnesota community measures, which are being, you know, used to kind of validate how is our care.
Mm-hmm.
It's just as good in, you know, and it's like anything. We're really good at some things and we're not so good at other things. But to be paid 40% less as a primary care physician, it just didn't feel quite right.
Right. Renee, does that happen? I assume that happens in California as well. Is this where government oversight might come in? Unfortunately, I have about a minute and a half left on this.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is when we talk about having the government play a role in leveling the playing field is where it comes in. I think that right now this is an example of where you might have a smaller provider who doesn't have a lot of leverage in negotiating, but they provide the same service and they're getting paid very differently. And this is where maybe when you allow the government to have a role and to say, maybe that's not quite right, and maybe we should require or at least have some kind of baseline adjustment, that this is where we can improve patient care, because you want these providers in the market. You want them to stay open. And if it continues to happen where the smaller players can't negotiate a good price, they may end up closing and you end up creating these monopolies.
Renee, I really appreciate you getting up early in San Francisco and joining the discussion. Really great to have your insight. Thank you. I hope you'll come back and talk
to
us again.
Thank you so much, Carrie. Thank you. It was
great. Thanks. Julie, really valuable to have your experience and all that data that you're collecting there. The website again to get these scores?
The website for consumers is mnhealthscores.org. And then they could also, if they're interested, go to mncm.org, which gives more information about our organization.
I'll tweet out the link as well if you hang out with me on Twitter. Julie, thank you. And more
thank
conversations
you.
To come, including checking out this book that was recommended to us during the discussion.